This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Smartphones have created a society in which many of us are always staring at our screens. Technology in general has begun to change our lives by demanding much more of our time. How much time do you spend on Facebook, checking Twitter, Instagram? Now, what about your kids? Children may know more about technology than you do, but they may not understand how cyberbullies can make their lives miserable. They may not know that they themselves are engaging in cyberbullying. They may also not understand how to deal with inappropriate behaviors on social media or be able to analyze the veracity of information that comes to them through their devices. Smartphones and other devices, as well as social media, are here to stay. So at what age should you let your child use them? How much screen time is too much? How worried should you be about this digital world? Well, our guests today say this should not be scary, but you should be smart about this. And they have some tips on how to do that and answers to many of the questions I just posed. Dr. Devorah Heitner is author of ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. She's also founder of Raising Digital Natives, a resource for people who want to cultivate a culture of responsible digital citizenship. Though she is raising her own digital native, she still has time to join us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And Michelle Eichard is back with us. She is a local parenting author and speaker. She's been with us in the past to talk about her book, Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. And I would imagine middle school is where the rubber meets the road for a lot of people with technology, smartphones, and the like. Welcome back, Michelle.
That's right. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. By the way, Dr. Devorah Heitner is speaking, goodness gracious, tonight at 7 o'clock at Charlotte Country Day. That's open to the public, but you have to RSVP, and you can go to Charlotte Country Day or call them and find out how to do that. And she's speaking tomorrow morning at 8:30 at the North Carolina Association of Independent Schools at the Concord Convention Center. Also, you have to RSVP for that. So, if kids today are digital natives because they're growing up in a world that surrounds them with technology and the internet, etc., that means that those of us who are of a certain age, who grew up before all this came into play, are analog natives. Now, we didn't, now you laugh, but that's true. We didn't drown in books and records. You remember records, right? We didn't drown in books and records and TV. So why do you think the ubiquitous presence of screens is so alarming to many people?
Well, I think anytime you have something that's new, it's a little scary for people. Mm-hmm. And the ways that adults controlled what kids had access to back in the analog years were a little bit different. So you didn't have user-generated content until the dawn of zines, maybe. So when now your kid can turn on YouTube and see really just anything, they can see other kids flipping bottles, they can also see porn, they can see ISIS beheadings, they can see things that are really scary, whereas back in the day, you know, our parents only had to keep us from watching things that they didn't want us to see in the broadcast world. But when I ask other people, you know, parents who are raising kids in the digital age, what were you not allowed to watch? They talk about things like, oh, you know, I wasn't allowed to watch Three's Company. Well, if the worst thing my 8-year-old could see was Three's Company, I would be jumping for joy because that's pretty, you know, not traumatic. Mm-hmm. I don't think he'd be traumatized by it.
So it's harder, I would think, to be a parent today than it was 20 years ago.
I think every generation of parents thinks, boy, this is the hardest time to raise a kid. And so I think that that's what we're hearing now. And I think that in some ways it feels true in the sense of this is all new to many parents. I talk with parents a lot who say, I'm not on Facebook. I don't know how to deal with my child entering this world. So the playground has
changed. Introduce me to those people. I want to meet
those people. Yes, I know. They're your favorite, right? There are people out there who don't engage with social media. I don't know many, but there are people who don't like it. But it is hard for parents nonetheless to figure out how to guide their kids through something that they did not grow up with.
Here's what I did not notice in the analog years. You could go to a restaurant and there would be people there with their children and they'd be having conversations. There would be couples there and they'd be having conversations. There would be people on dates and they'd be looking across the table at each other and having a conversation while they had dinner. Today, you can go to a restaurant and you can see entire tables of people who never, ever take their noses out of their phones, ever, or you got a table of parents with kids and the kids are playing games on their phones and never engage in conversation. Is that technology taking over, or is it parents abdicating their responsibilities to parenting?
I think it's all kinds of things. I mean, I think it's also just the informality. I mean, we didn't go out to eat nearly as often when I was a kid. And so the expectation that you would even take children out, especially to a nice restaurant, I think has really changed. And if we want kids to be quiet, screens are definitely one way to accomplish
Why?
That goal. Why do we want kids to be quiet?
No, why? If you want kids to be quiet, you got to give them a toy. Why?
Well, I think that's one way to accomplish that goal. I don't think it's necessarily the best way. And I also just don't take my kid out to restaurants very much. I mean, that's how I make it work.
If this is happening in restaurants, one could extrapolate that it's happening at home, probably to a greater degree, that kids never put the phones down, even while they're eating.
I think it reflects a lack of balance typically. So if I see people at a restaurant and they're all looking down at their phone, I do think that can be bothersome. However, I will say that kids tend to use technology to enhance their experience while they're together, and we often don't get that. So we may look at a group of people and say, ugh, they're all on their phones. That's terrible. When in reality, they may have just asked a question and no one knew the answer, and so they're quickly Googling it to figure it out. They're using it to add to the experience that they're having, and we think they're not having an experience.
I don't see a lot of that. What I see is a lot of kids texting each other across the table rather than speaking out loud. They'll text each other because mom and dad are so stupid that and I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean, in their minds, mom and dad are so stupid that we can't say this in front of them, but we can talk about them behind their backs. Is that what's happening too?
I don't think so. I think actually families may be talking with one another, and I see a lot of kids who are actually texting their parents and texting within the family. So,
really? During dinner? Why not say it out loud? What is this doing to socialization?
Kids still.
I'm really anti this. Can you tell this? I'm really against this.
Kids still really want face-to-face social time, but most kids don't get that during the week. Most kids commute to school and they don't see their friends. We don't give kids as much freedom to see their friends in the neighborhood as we may have had, so they're not roaming with as wide a radius on their bikes or on foot or in public transit to see friends. And then they miss their friends, and this is a way that they can spend time together during and after homework time in the evenings.
And we don't let them roam on their bikes too far away because we're afraid for them? Is that it?
Absolutely. The norms of parenting have shifted, and the expectation is we're keeping our kids much closer and knowing where they are.
We're afraid that they might be four blocks away or three blocks away, and they're not in visual sight, and they're not tethered to us. But we don't mind that they're on this device that gives them access to everything and everybody in the world?
I think that's what overwhelms parents so much, is they get that a phone is a really big deal, and it is this lifeline and connection to the world. And I think parents could do a better job in some cases mentoring kids about how to deal with that thoughtfully. But most kids get on social media and want to be with their actual friends. They are not looking to connect globally with strangers, for
example. What about talking?
I think most kids, to DeVore's point, most kids would choose if I said, you can get on your phone and you can sit in your home alone and you can chat with your friend via your phone, or I'm willing to drive you and your friend to the mall and you can walk around together. I think most kids would still choose the mall.
Really?
They crave time together. And when they are denied that time together in real life, in public, with an ability to sort of explore safely the world around them, then they tend to find different ways to connect. And so parents who, to your point, who when you see families where the kids are constantly facing a phone, I don't like that either. But I think they're sort of like, I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what to do. And part of what DeVore and I do is help parents figure out how to mentor that balance.
So how much of this being constantly in the screen, nose in the screen, is because they feel disconnected from their friends, and this is the only way they can be connected because parents have limited their access to travel on bikes and by sidewalks, et cetera. And how much of it is simply these devices are remarkably addictive?
Well, the apps are really fun, and if you're on Snapchat with a friend and you have to keep up your Snapchat streak by communicating every 24 hours, there is a pull to do that, and we can worry that kids are feeling a little too compelled or that the apps are a little too sticky and attractive. that is a concern. So one of the things I do is talk with families, talk with kids too about how can we balance that stickiness and attractiveness of that needing to connect every 24 hours or feeling like you need to post or check or like other people's things on social with other pursuits where that might be also really fulfilling, like hanging out in person and talking with your family or your friends face to face.
How do you reach that balance? Because even I've experienced this. I mean, these machines, these devices, computers, smartphones, tablets, etc., they can do so much. You can do everything in the known world by sitting in front of a screen. I mean, you can. Everything that used to require other equipment, other places to go, like a library, or you needed, if you need to record a video, you had to have a video camera and you had to have an editing device. It's all there. It's all in the same box. So you can sit there and do everything. Listen to music, write a term paper. Let's see what else you can do on that thing. Look up, use it as an encyclopedia or a dictionary, read a book. Can all be done on that screen. Not all screen time is created equal. I'm not sure where I'm going with this question, but how much of it is simply that these devices now do everything and therefore they consume us? We're not consuming them. They're consuming us.
We want to look at this qualitatively and say not just screen time, but is my kid creating? Are they writing music? Are they drawing? Are they designing a game? Or are they just watching and consuming? Mm-hmm. And of course, consumption isn't bad. When our kids are reading, they're also consuming. And so I think watching a good TV show or doing other kinds of consumption isn't a negative use of screen time. But I would look at that balance, and I do think differently about time that's spent creating. You know, you still don't want your kid up all night. So parents may want to look at, do we have these mobile devices in the bedroom? Is that a good idea? Seems like for most families, it's probably not. Most kids won't be able to resist the pull of having a mobile device in their bedroom. They might stay up all night.
I read a lot of your articles and a lot of other articles yesterday, but I think it was you who said that your devices, and I'm going to paraphrase here, your devices should not sleep in the same room as you do. Is that you?
For most of us, it's not a cozy night. Now, I have a spouse who loves to sleep with his device, and that's what we're communicating when our 8-year-old comes in to snuggle with us in the morning. The phones are right there. So we have to really think about, is that what we want to be communicating? And many families, the adults are sleeping with their phones even before the kids get phones, and that is communicating something.
But for kids, should their devices, be they smartphones or iPads or computers, should they be in their bedrooms ever? Because you can't keep your eye on what they're doing.
You want to work your way back from that kid you're going to drop off at college who is going to have his or her phone in the dorm room, and they may need to self-regulate around that. On the other hand, should your 11-year-old or 12-year-old have a phone in their room overnight? For most families, the answer is probably no. I never tell families what to do, but it seems like the advantages the disadvantages outweigh the advantages.
So it's age-dependent in your mind.
You have to learn to self-regulate at some point before you leave home.
So you deal a lot, Michelle, with middle schoolers.
Right.
At what point do you untether? At what point do you begin to trust their usage? Or is that are those the years when you begin to worry about how they're using those iPhones and things?
Well, I will say that most parents do begin to worry at the beginning of middle school. And what I tend to see, not just related to social media, but to middle school in general, is, oh, no, the world is opening up. I'd better clamp down. So suddenly my kid has access to all of this stuff, which frightens me, not just through technology, but, you know, maybe they're going to go to a party. Maybe they're going to experiment, things like that. So parents tend to have this urge to micromanage throughout middle school because they think there's so much danger, I'd better really clamp down here. And what ends up happening is an opposite effect, where the tighter parents tend to control things during these developmental years, the more kids feel the need to go underground to take risks. So there's been research, for example, I get asked a lot, should I install spyware so that I can see exactly what my kid is doing, and that way I can monitor and make sure they're not looking at pornography, they're not doing dangerous things.
Well, don't answer that question.
Okay.
It'll be our cliffhanger.
Ooh,
we'll
okay.
Come back and get an answer to that question. Should you install spyware? Should you keep an eye on your kids and their use of smart devices? We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at NC Warn, presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. ncwarn.org. And PNC Wealth Management, the PNC team, strives to provide insights that help customers make the most of their wealth. More information from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2129. Well, coming up tomorrow, the two candidates for Charlotte Mayor met this week on this program. We go over their differences and their similarities. Our bid for Major League Soccer appears to be dead for now. 5,000 people were said to gather for the first On the Table Charlotte event to talk about ways to improve our region, and the question of what to do about the old Eastland Mall site comes up for discussion. Again, we have details on those and other stories on the Local News Roundup tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, with most of Puerto Rico still in the dark, questions about why a tiny company with ties to the Trump administration just landed a $300 million contract to fix the island's electrical grid. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about digital devices and apps and things like that in the hands of young people, and how you as a parent should deal with that. At what age is it appropriate to give a child a smart device and access to the internet, etc., and how to use it. With Dr. Devorah Heitner, author of Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive Their Digital World, and the founder of Raising Digital Natives, which I believe is a website, correct? Michelle Eichard is the author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience Middle School Years. And she had just before the break gotten into this idea of, as kids get older and they begin to be curious more about things that perhaps concern you as a parent, should you install what is known as spyware on their phone so you can keep track of where they go on that device or their tablet or their computer? And I asked you to hold the answer. What is the answer?
So the big reveal, the answer is that research shows that installing spyware does not curb the kind of behavior that parents hope it would curb on the internet. So what happens is that when kids perceive a lack of trust from their parents, what they do is they go underground to find the stuff that they want to know. What that looks like would be, well, I'll just search on my friend's device for the information I want to have. Or I'll create a fake account so my parents can see my Instagram account here. But, of course, I have a Finsta, which is a fake Instagram, over here under a fake name. And that's where I really do all of my communicating. So if we set up initially this idea that this is a bad area, that your curiosity is bad, and that I don't want anything, you know, I don't want you to have anything to do with this, and so I'm going to spy on you to make sure that you don't do those things, kids tend to go elsewhere. And kids at this age are really driven to take risk. And so the more we clamp down on that and don't allow them some ways, it's natural as you grow up to take risks. We don't allow it.
This risk taking is actually built into their brains and their brain chemistry at that age, and they don't know how to control it because they're not even aware that it's happening. But Devorah, you say that instead of installing, you agree.
I think we need to mentor our kids more than we monitor. And I also think if we do monitor, if monitoring, like, for example, looking with your child at their texts when they're a new texter might be a way to collaborate on some monitoring, but I think covertly monitoring our kids really paints us into a bad parenting corner, because what do you then do if you see something? Can you say something? How bad does it have to be before you then reveal that you're covertly monitoring and you've gone all NSA on your kid?
And then what? Because your kid has already seen the thing, right? So if you're waiting to react afterwards and you're like, oh, I guess you looked at a pornographic site. The damage is done. They've already seen it. You really have to be more mentoring, as Devorah says, so that you can have those conversations before it happens.
So this scares a lot of parents, because this is, I guess, to somebody who grew up in the 50s and 60s, this would be like mom and dad coming in and finding Playboy magazine in the kid's bedroom. Only this thing is worse, much worse.
We no longer have the option of saying, I'll tell you when you're older. If your kid asks you a question, you have to sort of drop everything and answer, whether it's about God, sex, money, anything difficult, politics. We must talk with them right away, because they will instantly Google it if we blow them off.
Well, the question I was going to ask was, is this really is mentoring and parenting in a digital realm really any different than mentoring and parenting in the old days, in terms of how you approach things when they happen or after they happen?
I think we need to be more explicit with kids now about some communication choices, because our communication choices are more hidden. So there were a lot of opportunities to mentor by example in the phone years, when the phone was in a public space in the home. But much of my communication happens via email and text, and my 8-year-old isn't privy to that. So if I want to teach him how I handle a conflict appropriately, or how I deal with a difficult communication topic or task, then I have to say to him verbally, really explicitly say, wow, when things get difficult in a text message, we have to go to an in-person, face-to-face conversation, ideally to work it out. Sometimes you can't work things out once they go off the rails in a text. And there's no opportunity for him to just witness me doing that. So I have to be really clear about teaching.
And do you talk about when you text or when you use any kind of nonverbal communication, they don't see your face, they don't hear your voice, there's no inflection. Sometimes words can look really brutal when that's not what you intended had you said it out loud.
I think that is fascinating. I think that you're correct. And the flip side of that is that one reason teenagers love to text is because there's less room for misinterpretation. And what I mean by that is that part of this brain development stuff that you alluded to is that kids cannot read facial expressions to understand what a person is feeling until their prefrontal cortex is fully developed, and that happens in the early 20s. So there have been fascinating...
Really?
Yep. There have been a really fascinating studies.
Well, that explains high school, doesn't it?
Yes. It's why I say this all the time when I talk to parents. It's why when your kid comes in the door and you say, how did that math test go? And you have a sort of a furrowed brow, and they're like, oh, I can't believe you're mad at me. I don't even know how I did yet. And they storm off. They assume you're angry when you're not. So the ability to text without having to interpret a facial expression is really ideal for them.
Wow.
Because it's a way to overcome a handicap.
Here's something else that is interesting, and I think that's certainly different than things were 20 years ago. And that is when we watched a television show or played a game, we were usually watching together. Mm-hmm. So you could have it was a shared experience. You could have discussions about it or not. But we all saw the same thing at the same time. You sit around a table and play a board game or a card game when you're having conversation, or not. You're just playing the game, perhaps. But now we're all off in our own little universe, watching our own piece of video or playing our own game, sometimes with the device itself, sometimes with people we cannot see because it's online. What is that doing to kids?
I would say when kids are young, we have an opportunity to indoctrinate them into our taste culture more by sharing with them. And I wouldn't allow them to just do their own thing all the time and drown in their content and not be influenced by our content. So I think it's a great opportunity to get your kids into the things you like in media. And then as they get older, they're going to find their own things, their own pop music, their own things that they love, and they can share those things with you. So I don't think we need to allow, you know, everyone in a family to be in their corner watching their own media all the time. I think that it can still be a shared experience.
But mom, everybody has one. That's the key question here. When does that question start being asked by kids about, I want my own phone, my own device?
At the beginning of middle school, for sure, because they're in a building typically with kids who are a couple years older than them. And so the appearance is that, yes, everyone has one. I do want to quickly revert to what you were just talking about.
Okay.
And say that, you know, in terms of everyone being siloed and looking at their phones, absolutely every family should have media free time. And so for me, if I've rented a movie and I've paid $6 on UVerse and we're all sitting down to watch it, I don't let my kids pull out their phone during the movie because I want us all to be experiencing it. That's phone free time, not media free. But then if we're going on a hike or if we're, you know, sometimes during the car, I'll say, put your phone away. So I just wanted to say that for parents listening, this is not to say that it is a free for all. You should establish times when you say we're not going to be looking at screens together. Back to your question about the appropriate age, I would say that most kids have a cell phone. I think the statistics say by 10. Am I right about that? Yes. So by 10. Doesn't mean a smartphone, but it means most kids have a cell phone. Doesn't mean your family has to fall into that category. There are lots of things that you should consider before you allow your kid, and we can talk about some of what those metrics are.
So if your kid is 10 and your intent is to give them the smartphone because they keep pestering you about this, what – do you just give them an open phone and say, download what you want?
Absolutely not.
How do you do with it? How do you control it?
First of all,
because these kids know more about this than you do.
First of all, I wouldn't go with the pestering at all. That would be irrelevant to me. My kid pesters me for lots of things. I just ignore it. But I would really look at what is the story of his life. And if your child is never unsupervised by an adult, they probably don't need a phone because they have no independent communication needs. So I would really look at need. Is your child home alone? Are they supervising a younger sibling? Are you expecting your child to walk from middle school to the elementary school and pick up another kid? Is your child on public transit making multiple transfers where they could conceivably get lost and need to call someone? if your child has independent communication needs, then they may need some kind of phone to cover that time. That doesn't mean that you should get them a phone because you miss them when they have an away soccer game once a month and you can't deal with the fact that they're not texting you because there's an adult on that bus in the away soccer game and that adult can text you if there's a medical emergency, for example. So I think a lot of parents are looking at their own communication needs with their child and thinking this is a great time to get them a phone because I miss them when I can't reach them or it makes me nervous. And they don't really think about the fact that they're opening up a whole set of communication competencies for their kid that they may not be ready for. Your child may not be ready to be in touch with his or her peers in a group text when they're 10 years old. So I would hold off on the phone until your child shows some other signs.
I would think like anything else at that age, there's a certain fashionista aspect to phones. They all want the iPhone 6 or whatever is the latest model of the Android phone is that they want that does all the super duper stuff. What should you give them? What kind of phone should a 10-year-old have?
Well, there is no should. This is not to say that because 10 is the norm, a 10-year-old should have a phone. But when you are ready to give your child a phone, whether that's 10, 11, 12, 13, whatever it is, what I think happens a lot is parents say, well, I'm ready for an upgrade, so I'm going to give you my old phone because I want the new whatever it is.
Right.
That's probably not the best way to approach it. I mean, it might make sense financially, but I think it's a nice idea whenever you're teaching a kid how to use a new tool. A couple things. I think it's a nice idea to start when they are young enough that they are willing to listen to you about how to use it. So that is the advantage of getting in early on something like this because your kid desperately wants it and they still want to please you in order to be able to keep it. That's important. And then like for my kids back in the day, you know, they got phones 5 years ago, it was just a simple slide phone where you slide the whatever that piece is and you get to the keyboard.
Yeah.
I like the idea of starting as basic as possible.
But if you did that to a kid today, it would be like giving them a typewriter.
They'd be mortified, yeah. But I would still look at what is my most basic option here. Because I also think it's important not to spoil a kid and to say, you start with something really basic and work your way up.
Well, go ahead.
Many kids have devices, too, that do a lot of the things that phones do before they have phones. So parents often create this big deal in their brain about how a phone is going to be this huge thing and a smartphone. And then they've given their kid, you know, an iPod Touch or something else or a tablet that does all of the things that kids want to do on phones. Because the last thing your child wants to do on a phone, I promise you, is have a phone call and talk to someone on the phone. So if they can already text, if they can already FaceTime, if they can already game live with a friend, they may be doing a lot of the things that we think they're doing. And some kids may be doing that at 7, 8, and 9. We have to look at that too.
You bring up an interesting point. Nobody uses these things to make phone calls anymore. Not even parents. You just said 5 seconds ago that if your kid is on a bus trip and there's an adult on the bus and there's a medical emergency, they can easily text you. Wouldn't you want them to call you? I mean, seriously. But that's number one. Number two, these kids don't want to talk. But they will use FaceTime. It's the same thing. They're having a conversation and just seeing a face on the other end of the screen.
Well, that's part of their craving time with each other.
But what's wrong with the phone? I don't care.
I mean, it's like, what's wrong with writing a letter? Nothing's wrong with it. It's just not current. It's not how it feels. Now, I will say there are lots of things I hope parents will do to encourage their kids to be verbal.
Uh-huh.
One of them is using the phone. So when my kids were little, they would always say, will you order us a pizza? And I would say, you can order the pizza. Pick up the phone and make the call. I'll pay for the pizza. And that they hated that. That drove them crazy. But I would insist.
Why? Why do
they don't want to talk to someone on the phone. They don't know how, right?
And that's my point.
To their point,
of course they
it's
don't.
Not really modeled for them. But I want them to learn how to do that. I don't want that to be a lost art.
I want to come back.
You don't want the first call they get to be offering them a job.
Right.
And they're on the other end like,
could you text me the offer?
I want to talk about modeling in a second. But here's a question that I think that needs to be considered. And it may be a question that you raised in one of your articles, Devorah. And that is, you need to consider before you give your child a device how they're going to compensate you if they break or lose that device. Is that yours?
No.
No? Well, how should that be a consideration?
It could be if that's your deal with other things.
These are expensive devices.
Right. If that's your deal with other things, then you could think about that. I think more –
Lose your new iPhone 6. It's $1,000 or whatever it is.
Well, it may not be financial compensation, too. It could be another kind of compensation.
Do you give them a new phone when they lose the phone or break the phone? Or do you just say, yep, too bad?
there are parents who have their kids pay for their own plans and other things. And I think that is one way you can get your kid to feel responsible.
That's a heck of an allowance to pay for your own plan.
Right.
Let's talk about modeling, because I was going to ask how much screen time is enough screen time, but how would you know? Because you can use these devices to do so many different things, including reviewing the notes you took in class. But parents tend to have a lot of time in their screens. So if you're doing it, why shouldn't your child? And it looks normal to them. You need to monitor. You need to set the example, correct?
Correct. So what that means is if you don't want your child to pick up their phone and start scrolling through it while you're telling them something, you'd better not do the same thing, right? If you don't want your kid to bring your phone out at the table, then you probably shouldn't either. I do think there's some flexibility around that. Generally speaking, we don't bring phones to the table in our house. And we never had to really specify that. It's just something that our family never did. But I'm flexible about it. If somebody wants to go check something really quickly because we're having a good conversation and we're curious when a movie came out, I'm okay with that.
Is there etiquette being taught to these kids by anybody, parents, teachers, about when and where it is appropriate to scroll through your device, when it is appropriate to respond to little noises that tell you that you've just gotten a text or you've gotten an Instagram update or a Facebook update? Never mind the phone ringing for a call. That's never going to happen. Is there any kind of etiquette that tells them when it's okay to and not to respond?
Well, that's one of the things that I do in my workshops is I talk with families about how to teach kids etiquette around these things. And I also talk with kids about what they see in terms of the modeling we were just discussing. Mm-hmm. And kids tell me a lot of things. So I travel all over the country talking with kids, and they tell me that their parents text and drive, that their parents sometimes say, I'll be with you in 5 minutes, and then it's an hour because their parents are lost in their phones. So kids are seeing some negative modeling in terms of etiquette. I learned, because I'm much more of a laptop person than a phone person, that I could look at my child over the top of my laptop and he really didn't feel heard. So I have to close my laptop and put it away if we're having a conversation, or let him know an actual time that I'll be available, not in 5 minutes, but at 9:48, because that keeps me more honest.
But as a kid, even before answering machines, if the phone rang during dinner, we didn't answer it.
Right. And I
now
think
today,
plenty of families
if your
way.
Phone goes bing, you've got to pick it up right now.
I think it changes family to family. I know plenty of families, mine included, who we don't look at our phones during a meal. As you mentioned, lots of families do. So part of what we hope is that parents will feel like it's okay to have rules around this. It's okay to set up parameters before I even give my kid a phone. In fact, that's my recommendation.
There's less of a shared sense of etiquette, though, where we may have thought, okay, no one will call during dinner because everyone has that same rule, or no one will call after 10 because everyone has that same rule. Many families do feel like they're not sure what their kids' friends' rules are. So it's something that I encourage families to do is if your child has close friends that they're initially communicating with a lot, like say in the middle school years, you know, you should know what their rules are too. So if you can text till 9, but your best friend can't text after 8, don't text her after 8.
Right.
And don't text again and again and again if someone doesn't respond to you. And this is the plague of new texters, is the second they don't get a response, they think my friend hates me. So I try to get kids to really imagine, okay, your friend might be swimming, they might be sleeping, they might have used up all their phone time for the day. There are many reasons. They may be doing homework or eating with their family. There are many reasons someone might not text you back, and that's okay.
We'll talk about rules and how parents deal with other parents' rules in a moment. We have to take a break. Dr. Devorah Heitner is here, author of ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive Their Digital World, and Michelle Eichhardt is with us as well. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting Beethoven's First Symphony, plus pianist Robert Levin improvises the cadenzas of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23 this Friday and Saturday at Belk Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. And Katt Wealth Consulting, LLC. Martha Katt is a financial advisor specializing in retirement planning for State of North Carolina employees. Online at CATTWealth.com. Dots.com. Large swaths of Puerto Rico still don't have electricity more than a month after Hurricane Maria, and now questions are being raised about why a tiny company with ties to the Trump administration just landed a $300 million contract to fix the island's electrical grid. Host Jane Clayson is in for Tom Ashbrook. That'll be the topic on Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our conversation about technology and smartphones and the like for children in a moment.
Your mornings can be chaotic, and those glances at news alerts and all those headlines make things more confusing.
They will not vote this week on their latest proposal to dismantle.
Secretary Tom Price has resigned after mounting pressure.
Southern Puerto Rico have been standing in line for water that they can't.
Morning Edition has in-depth coverage of the day's biggest stories, plus the conversations you need to hear, all up to date and in one place. Listen every day.
Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Devorah Heitner, author and founder of, Raising Digital Natives and author of ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive Their Digital World. Michelle Eichardt is back with us. She's local, and she is the author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. We're just talking about rules that parents set for their kids, and they should, for how they use their cell phones and when they use them and what time they at night they have to stop using them, things like that. But not every parent has the same set of rules, as you just mentioned. Perhaps a child that your child is texting doesn't respond because they're not allowed to use the phone after this hour anymore, so stop texting them because they can't answer you, and very possibly their phone is off. But should you, as a parent, check with the close friends of your child, their parents, to see what their rules are? And how do you deal with it if their rules are very different from yours?
It's great to check. With younger kids and playdates, you absolutely want to know if there's unrestricted internet access and, you know, your five-year-old might be on YouTube with someone else's five-year-old. You absolutely want to know as much as possible. And the sensitive way, the trick that I would use is to talk about your kid being sensitive to scary content and things like that, as opposed to saying, are you one of those parents that doesn't monitor your kids at all and has no idea what's going on? You can also think about in your own home, because many parents think they know what's going on, but really think about the physical space where connected devices are. So for younger kids with playdates, you definitely do want to supervise what they're doing online. You do not want your kids in the basement on the internet with a bunch of other kids.
And although you don't say, you say that you should not install spyware, you don't discourage parents from putting certain gateways or restrictions on their Wi-Fi.
You can absolutely do that if you want to, but there's no substitute for just being there. If your kid wants to check out some things on YouTube, there's amazing content there too. But ideally, with a young child, you're with them. And for an older child, they have a sense of, these are some things we don't look up on YouTube.
You know, the American Academy of Pediatrics recently changed their guidelines for screen time and how much is appropriate.
Okay.
And they used to say nothing before age two. Now they're saying it's less about time spent in front of the screen and more about who you're spending time with in front of the screen. To your point, having a parent next to you to look at something online is not that bad because you can discuss it and you can have a human interaction about what you've seen. But if you're using the iPad as a babysitter, that's not a good thing.
Okay. You and we've talked a little bit about the fears that parents may have, legitimate fears they may have about access to inappropriate conduct or content, rather, by their kids, because some kids are not going to necessarily actively look for this, but they might inadvertently stumble on it because you can put a Google search term in and get all kinds of things that you didn't intend to see. And I believe, Devorah, you had your son, who was, I think, 8 at the time, came across some material that you would have preferred him not to come in contact with. How did you handle that?
Well, and it was on the broadcast news, and he was with my father. Thanks, Grandpa Howard. And he saw a police murder, and it was terrifying for him. And he was 6, and I wish he hadn't seen it. But we had to talk about it, and I had to also see what he'd seen, not with him, and I didn't re-traumatize him by watching it again. But I had to also recognize that he didn't understand everything that he saw. And so I asked him to explain to me what he saw. And I really tried to keep the panic out of my response, because what I want is for him to be able to come to me with the things he sees online that make him uncomfortable or surprised or confused, as opposed to reacting in such a way that he might in the future hide from me and not talk with me.
But that happened on broadcast television,
yes.
Right? So a lot of things that kids might come across online, you would never know about because it's not a shared experience. It's not something that you were looking for. They were sitting in their bedroom or outside on the back porch, and they were surfing the web, and there it was. And you don't know it. So how do you deal with that?
So that's why it's important to send cues to your kid early on that you're a safe person to talk to about these things. And one of the ways that you do that is you don't wait for your kid to stumble across pornography, because they will. They're going to stumble across pornography online. Even if you don't have any Wi-Fi access at your house, they're going to do it on a friend's phone. They're going to see it at some point during their adolescence. It's like 92% of boys and 65% of girls or something like that. So you've got to send cues that say, I'm a safe person to come and talk to. And one of the ways you can do that is by being explicit and saying, look, I know that you may come across this. It's likely that you will come across this. Here's what I want you to do when that happens. I want you to shut down the device. I want you to walk away. And I want you to know that you can talk to me so I can help you process it, because it's not a
realistic. How do you have that conversation for somebody who has not yet stumbled upon it?
You want to do it before they stumble upon it.
Yes, but how do you have that conversation? They don't even know what you're talking about.
Right. So, I mean, certainly by the time your kid is in middle school, you need to have a conversation with them about pornography. So by the time they're going into sixth grade, you've got to say, there is something called pornography, and this is what it is, you know, and explain it. And I know that that sounds terrifying, but if you wait to be reactive, then your kid will think, this is a shameful thing I have never heard of before, and I cannot go talk to my parent about it.
There's a great book called Talk to Me First, and that's a really good one, just about how you can get your child to see you as a great source of information about puberty, sexuality, other things. We cannot do what our parents may have done, which is answer a question like, we'll talk about that later, or I'll let you know. And it's also good for us to let our kids know that it's normal to be curious about your body, how it's changing, sexual relationships. Those things are normal to want to know about, but we need to make sure they have age-appropriate ways to find out, also truthful information. And we need to give them reasons to not look at porn other than it's bad, don't do it.
Right.
But to really say, this can negatively impact relationships, or, you know, whether you have a religious or a feminist or a political or a personal or an economic reason, I would talk with my kid about, this is an exploitative industry. It hurts people, right? And also it can hurt your future relationships. And there's data about that. So those are some really concrete reasons that I would give a child.
So this is a conversation that's difficult to have, but it's also a conversation that might be easier to have when a child is pre-middle school.
Right.
Because at that age, at middle school age, that's when they begin to pull away. Their parent isn't the know-it-all anymore. There isn't the hero anymore. The parent doesn't know anything anymore. So if you don't have that conversation, if that's when you have that conversation, are they likely to listen to you at that age? Because you don't know anything, Mom.
I think it's not a one-time conversation. I think it's probably a series of conversations that starts with, huh, look at how they treated that woman on this sitcom that we're watching. That wasn't very nice, right? So it starts with that, and then that progresses into bigger and bigger conversations. I know my kid said, you never had the sex talk with us. And I was like, are you kidding me? We had so many. But they think of it in their mind as like a big one-time awful horrible talk. And really, all of these conversations are things that you have over a series of years. And you look at what's happening culturally and environmentally around you, and you talk about it.
And I think we've talked about this before on your previous visits. They want to talk about this, and they want your guidance, and they want to know what you think. But on the other hand, they would never tell you that.
That's
right?
Exactly right. And there are surveys where kids have responded and said, I wish my parents would tell me more about sex. I'd like to be more knowledgeable. I don't want to look like a fool when something comes up and then I have to Google it because everyone's talking about it.
But this is true about everything
at
that age. I mean, they want your guidance, and they want to know that you're interested, and they want to know that they can come to you. But then when you come to them, it's like, oh, Mom, right?
Yes, it's true. And it's also in how you talk to them. So what they really don't want is to feel judged.
Okay.
And so if you can approach things by asking, it sounds like you're playing dumb almost. Like, so tell me what this is like, or tell me how you're using your phone, or what are kids doing these days? And you put them in a position of authority to explain something to you. That works really well. But they don't want you to come down with a judgmental final statement. You will not get online.
And you have said in the New York Times, you wrote an article, Devorah, that talks about rules. And you said that despite all the rules that parents may make, The most important rules are those that children create for themselves, and these often unspoken rules can be dizzying.
Absolutely.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So they're really policing one another about what they share. For example, I wrote in that article about girls policing one another about what kinds of images of themselves that they'll share, whether it's ever appropriate to share a picture of yourself in a bathing suit, for example. And middle school girls will judge one another quite harshly for sharing a picture that seems like it's trying too hard to be sexy. By high school, kids may feel like that's an okay thing to want to present about yourself, but there's a lot of second guessing, a lot of kids judging other kids negatively. It's not okay to be too modest. It may not also not be okay to be too explicit. Mm-hmm. So it's very tricky and it's very local. So I wouldn't assume that the rules about, you know, that those kids shared in that article are the rules for your kid. I would really ask them, what are the things that you see kids doing where other kids are judging them for stepping out of line? Because that's how the rules become very visible. Mm-hmm. And I also, to come back to the sexuality conversation, just another moment, I wouldn't assume that just because you see kids, if you are monitoring your child and you see kids using very graphic terms in a group text, I still wouldn't assume that they know what those mean. So that happens a lot. Parents will say, oh, I guess my kid knows everything. Their friends really have naughty mouths and everyone's talking, you know, and using bad words. But that doesn't mean your kid has any idea what that means or what the implications are. So it's very important not to assume too much knowledge about our kids.
And you have a list of behaviors when it comes to texting, group texting, sharing texts, etc., that you've put out there. What are those rules that you're suggesting?
Well, we want to be considerate. And just remember, there's another human being on the other end of all these communications, whether it's a group text where I might be leaving someone out or talking negatively about someone, or whether it's sharing a photo where my friends might not be included. I have to remember there's other human beings looking at this and really think about, is this something that's contributing to my relationships, or would I be best perhaps not sharing this?
Krista on Facebook writes, you can take any and all technology from children, but they will always find access to what they want to see. We must teach children when to use technology properly, and both of you would agree with that.
Right.
Robin on Facebook, can you address the fact that many schools issue computers and iPads for the students to use for homework? How do you create a balance between legitimate use for school and video gaming?
Well, this is a frustrating point for me, I will say. I understand the need to use a pad for homework, but what I find frustrating is that I noticed with my kids, the amount of time they spend reading an actual book in school has gone down, because when the teacher is done teaching a lesson and say there's 20 minutes left and some kids are catching up on an assignment or whatever, they just say, you can pull out your pads and mess around. Where it used to be, oh, my only choice now is to reach into my backpack and pull out a paperback right, and start to read it. So I find that really frustrating. I don't have a good answer for it except to say I empathize with that comment. And so all I feel I can do at that point is say, hey, I've noticed that you haven't been reading as much. Do you miss reading? Remember some of your favorite books, and try to have a conversation with my kid.
So kids at that age face intense peer pressure that many adults perhaps have forgotten what that's like, but it's intense. And social media, I think, has upped the ante on that, because social media lives and dies on likes, mm-hmm. whether you like a post that somebody has put up there or not. What's the downside of measuring yourself against how many likes you get on a picture you put on Instagram or whatever it may be?
Well, we don't want to crowdsource our popularity or our identity. So if I am letting my friends crowdsource what I like by, you know, how much they like this outfit versus that outfit, or if I'm quantifying my popularity by thinking, well, my friends have this many Instagram followers, but I don't really know that many people. Should I have more followers? Should I let strangers follow me to up my numbers? Those are some questions that can be really painful. And that's why apps like Musical.ly that appeal to really young kids, I would be really cautious about, because you might not want your second or third grader, you know, quantifying the number of people who are following them. That's a very young age mm-hmm. to experience that. All of our kids need to know the difference between a follower and a true friend. And a true friend is the one who is showing up for you in a deep way when something bad happens in your life, or you would be there for them in a serious way. Most of us can count those people on one hand.
But this comes back to good old-fashioned parenting and conversation versus technology. So as a parent, when your child is entering this world, it's up to you to explain these concepts to them. A like does not equate to your value.
But are you fighting a losing battle? Because researchers at UCLA found that the pleasure centers in teenagers' brains respond to the rewards of getting likes on Instagram exactly as they do about thoughts on sex or money. It lights up.
Yeah, I think it feels good. And I've experienced that as an adult. Like, oh, people are really responding to this online. I like that feeling. So I get that. I would say it's not a losing battle, but it is a consistent conversation that you need to be having with them. And so you might talk to your child about that. I see you're getting a lot of feedback on that. You know, what? Tell me about that.
So these rules that you may set as a parent, they should change over time.
Oh, yes.
You should be elastic about this.
It's a dynamic process.
How do you know when you're right and when you're just being a scaredy cat or you're actually hurting your child because they live in a world that you don't know and your restrictions are actually impeding them? How do you know you're doing the right thing?
Well, first of all, your kid will be okay. So a lot of parents will say to me,
for example,
my friends – because most kids are most of the time. So there's lots of data on that. You know, for example, if I watched too much or too little TV as a kid, I mean, there's no really such thing as too little, but if I watched too much TV as a kid and I'm not a sociopath and lots of us maybe were raised by the TV in the 70s and 80s and we're okay, there's a lot of data. Your kid will probably be fine. If you don't let your kid lie about his or her age to join social media at a young age, for example, if you say, I'm going to go with 13 because that's what Instagram and Snapchat say, I'm not going to let you get on at 11, your kid will be fine.
But the things that you watched on television in the 70s and 80s were far tamer than some of the stuff that you can find on the internet today.
That's true, but I guess what you're saying about the rules is the rules won't hurt your kid, but I agree with what Michelle says too. You don't want to drive your child underground. So you want to make sure that the rules are something you're in dynamic conversation with your child about so that he doesn't feel like, oh, I need a fake account. I need a private browser. I'm going to use my friend's phone to break all the rules.
Give me three apps that parents need to know about that they may not know about, that their kids certainly know about.
It's not about the apps. It really is about what your kid is doing with the apps. Lots of kids are using Snapchat and Instagram. Some kids are using Musical.ly. But it's not about the apps. It's really about what is your child doing on the apps? Who are they relating with on the apps? And is this affecting them in a positive or negative way?
It's Dr. Devorah Heitner, author of ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World, and founder of Raising Digital Natives. It's a website you can go to. And Michelle Eichardt, author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. Thank you both for the